Hi there, podcasters, or may I call you hummers, from this is the podcast with me, Robert Krulwich, this is a little extra thing we do from time to time. I'm going to just talk to you, just you, because you happen to be plugged into this thing. It being Darwin's birthday anyway, so one thought keeps coming up when you celebrate Darwin's 200th, is what did he have as a scientist that other scientists did not have? And New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik has a new book, Angels in Ages, which includes a biographical sketch of Darwin. He, by the way, adored Origin of the Species. I mean, absolutely adored it.
I was just knocked out by it. And to this day, in a lifetime of probably too much reading, of all the things I've ever read, it was the thing that was the purest experience where you said, I opened this book as one person and I closed it and I was another person.
But why? I wondered. Gopnik says that it really has a lot to do with Darwin as a writer, but even more important than that, with Darwin as a looker. He was a very, very great examiner of stuff. He had a very democratic eye. He would look everywhere. He was kind of open-minded about comparisons. He could look at a bird. He could look at a worm. He could be fascinated by a barnacle for years, and he could give you a real feel for a creature.
From the very beginning, if Darwin had died in 1838 before he came up with his great idea, he still would be remembered for his writing in the account of the Voyage of the Beagle. He's one of the great observers of the 19th century. He just knows how to look. He loves to look. When he was a little boy, he loved looking at things. He was an exasperation and an enormous disappointment to his father because he didn't seem to have any gift for the kind of rhetorical argument that lawyers need or the kind of mastery of craft that doctors have or the oratorical skills that a priest or a preacher has.
So he wasn't what you'd call these days a fast processor.
Not one bit.
Not that you could tell.
Not that you could tell. He was underneath the table with beetles in his mouth, and he was one of those obsessive kids who cares about one or two things at a time. In his case, he cared about bugs enormously. And his father was in despair because this kid, what he was in our parlance, he was on the spectrum. All you could get him to talk about and look at was bugs.
And yet, a lot of parents would think, uh-oh, dumb.
Exactly. Would think dumb, difficult. And his father wrote to him, said to him, you will never be good for anything but dog racing and rat catching. And it was just, and you can imagine what a stab in the heart that was to a bright kid. But that was the kind of mind he had. And if you read a single page of The Voyage of the Beagle, of his account of The Voyage of the Beagle, one of the things that makes it so amazing is that everything he's seeing is beautifully described so that you see it too. And it's done so transparently that you don't stop and think, boy, that is hard to do. But I tell the anecdote in the book, I was in the middle of rereading The Beagle. We were down in the beach in the Caribbean, and I thought, this guy's amazing. He can describe so well. I think, well, I'm not the world's worst describer. It's what I do for a living, too. So I put a snorkel on. I went out into the little, reef pond there, and just to look at fish. I thought, I'm going to look and write down everything I've seen. And when you try and do that in a disciplined way, you realize how impossibly difficult what Darwin does so naturally, that is simply describing the look and behavior of organisms, of animals, how difficult that really is.
So let me give you an example of what Adam is talking about. There's a woman named Deborah Heiligman who's also written a book about Darwin. Her book is called Charles and Emma, and it describes their marriage. And in Deborah's description, when Charles meets Emma, they do, like couples do, a little hugging, a little kissing. And when Darwin starts to kiss his girlfriend, he notices that his mouth is a little wetter. He's got a little bit sort of a saliva thing going on, greater flow. Now, a romantic writer would say, I'm transported by kissing my girlfriend. My lips are moist. Hers are moist, too. But no, not Darwin, because Darwin is very given to the idea that humans are animals, that we're beasts, and that we're enmeshed in the web of life, and that our behaviors and the behaviors of cats and dogs and horses and stuff are just, are very related. I was going to say just the same, but he didn't believe that. But that the things that we do, we can see other creatures doing too, even if we're talking about kissing the first real love of your life. Here's Deb.
He says, in one of his private notebooks, he had all these private leather-bound notebooks. Yeah. And in some of those notebooks, he was writing about his theory of evolution by natural selection. And some of those notebooks, he was writing about emotions, which this is all about natural selection and evolution. It's all about that. Everything is in service to that. But he's also writing about sex because he's getting
having some.
He's having some, or he's about to have some. I guess this is when they're still engaged. He says, sexual desire makes saliva to flow. And then we could see, because of the way his notebooks are preserved, that he wrote later, yes, certainly. So I wonder about that. And then he also wrote, he had a curious association thinking about his new, about Emma. And he thought of watching his old family dog, Nina, licking her chops. He's just really thinking about how we're all connected. So he's kissing Emma. His saliva is flowing. He sees Nina. She's licking her chops. He wonders, saliva, chops, mouth, licking. Where does this all come from evolutionarily? Why do we have saliva? So he writes, you know, basically, the same thing as a dog mommy licking her puppies to clean them probably has the same thing to do with kissing.
So his machine is working all the time.
All the time. And he wrote, I love this part, he wrote, one's tendency to kiss and almost to bite that which one sexually loves is probably connected with flow of saliva and hence the action of mouth and jaws. He also wrote, lascivious women are described as biting. So do stallions always.
Whoa.
I mean, he's just, he's, and when he talks about the puppies, the mothers licking the puppies, he says, this habit probably originated in the females carefully licking their puppies, the dearest object of their love, for the sake of cleansing them. Thus, the habit will have become associated with the emotion of love. So I guess he's thinking, mother animals lick their babies, who they love more than anything else in the world. And so you associate licking and saliva and love. And so
therefore kissing. But what's really going on here is you have a range of looking, a generosity of thinking about behavior that just happens to go along to whatever is, in view, dogs, horses, which is what his life.
Right, right.
Later on, worms and barnacles and other things.
Right.
But he's he doesn't stick to home base very much. His mind travels to other creatures.
Right, but I think he would consider that home. I mean, he does a lot of observing, you know.
And he didn't feel that if his eye moved from Emma to a horse, that he was switching subjects. The subject was still, we're all animals. That's very, very key to Darwin. Here again is Adam Gopnik.
And he's superbly good at doing that. So you can see everything. It's describing how it's some innocuous bug in South America draws itself back like a little spring and then leaps forward as though by the natural motion of the earth. That kind of description.
Well, so since you're a wordsmith too, so you're getting a little on the jealous side. So you mentioned that, I mean, usually with a Galileo or with people who are dealing with fairly big subjects, they'll use gorgeous metaphor. They'll say, this is just like that. But I gather that Darwin didn't go that way.
One of the interesting things about Darwin as a stylist, as a prose writer, is that he very rarely uses metaphor or analogy. He uses it very sparingly. It's one of the great explanatory tools of the sciences is metaphor. And think about how many times Einstein searched for a metaphor for special relativity over and over again.
Well, but he could, what was he going to do? There were no insects jumping in it.
He had to make up a metaphor that would allow you to see a very complicated and very counterintuitive idea. But Darwin could do that. And of course, one of the things that's fascinating to do is to always compare what Darwin says with what T.H. Huxley, his bulldog, his great popularizer and supporter, how Huxley argues for Darwin. And Huxley is rich with metaphor and analogy and illustration. Darwin does that very sparingly because he wants the argument to be based on real things. He wants it to be based or seem to be based only on observation. In other words, he's saying you don't have to buy into a complicated metaphor. You don't have to buy into a rhetorical picture. Just buy into the reality of this thing here. Do you buy that description? That's the way it is? Okay. Let's go on to the next thing.
Not only is it nouns, when you get to your adverbs, he says you like merely, mm-hmm. moderately, small, slight. He uses modest modifiers.
Always. And those are the words of Darwinism. I did a thorough word search through all the works of Darwin, and there are certain words he never uses. He never uses transcendental, rarely uses inspire, illuminate. All the words of Romanticism are expunged from his vocabulary.
And instead, Adam finds Darwin likes slight, small, varied, struggle, helpful, hopeful, natural, selection, modest, modification, modest words that he repeats over and over and over. So here's a guy who sticks small words together and comes up with one very, very big idea. So, that's the podcast. Nice to be occasionally whispering in your ear. Maybe we'll do this more often. Bye-bye.